Hi, this is Allison Sheridan of the No Silly Cast podcast, hosted at podfeed.com, a technology geek podcast with an ever-so-slight Macintosh bias, a proud member of the Tech Podcast Network. If it's tech, it's here. Today is Sunday, June 25th, 2006, and this is show number 49. Well, school's out for summer and the kids are all over the house, so I'm actually back in my normal studio. In fact, I think I'm going to call this my winter studio, and I usually have my summer studio downstairs, but there's kids everywhere making all kinds of noise. So I begged Lindsay to let me back in her room for a little bit, and she did let me use the studio. Let's jump into some listener feedback. Debbie T. of splashofstyle.com wrote in about a problem she's having burning CDs and DVDs on her Mac. The problem she's having is that whenever she works on her Mac while she's doing a burn, she gets a verification error at the end of the burn. Now, the burn isn't actually bad. There's not necessarily anything wrong with it. It just says it couldn't verify that it was a good burn. I realize that I've seen this before, too, and in the couple of cases I've seen it, the burn did appear to be good. I was able to use the CD and check the files on it. She also made a note that if she just simply has another program running that's using system resources, like, say, an email program that might go out and check for mail, and she's not even touching it, that'll cause this verification error, too. By the way, she's simply burning the CDs and DVDs from the Finder, not using iDVD or anything like this. I'm curious if anybody knows what this means, why it happens, should we worry our pretty little heads about it? Debbie also gave me a link to a little blurb she wrote on her website about a service called Box.net. Box.net is an online storage site where you can store up to 1 gigabyte of information for free, or up to 5 gigabytes for only $4.99 a month. The site says it's a good way to share photos and files that are too big for email and allows you to synchronize and back up folders. There's a lot more features than I have time to go into right now, but you can check out Debbie's link on splashofstyle.com. Go over there and do a search on free storage, or you can click the link I put in the show notes. In her little blurb, she covers some important security features of Box.net as well. Thanks for the cool tip, Debbie. I didn't know about Box.net, and I bet I'm going to find a way to use that. Listener Susan from apotter.org wrote in with a report on a neat little feature available in Microsoft Mice. It's a screen magnification button that's on the left side. Now, I happen to have a Microsoft mouse. I know, find that hard to believe, but Microsoft makes really nice mice. Anyway, on the left side, there's a little button, and I always kind of wondered what it was for. And it turns out it's a screen magnification tool. It's built into the drivers for the tool, so I went on over to check it out. She said that it works well for people like her with variable partial eyesight, and the mouse product acknowledges the baby boomers' population needs. You know, we're all getting older, not any younger. She also said the Microsoft Laser Mouse plus the Text Aloud Reader work well together as a starter kit for aging eyes. So, like I said, it sounded pretty cool, and I had to dig around on the Microsoft site to find it, and I found the drivers for my mouse, so I downloaded the ones for Windows and for the Mac. And I was able to find a good demonstration of how it's supposed to work, so I knew what I was looking for, but I couldn't actually get it to work. I can't figure out what I'm doing wrong, but I'll be darned if I can get that little button to do anything in terms of magnifications. In Windows, I thought maybe it's because USB is still a little bit hinky through Parallels, but in OS X, it didn't do anything either. I looked at the driver in both operating systems, and both of the driver menus said the button on the left thumb area was set to magnify, but pushing it just doesn't do anything at all. In OS X, it said I should, the control said I should go over to the Universal Preference pane. That's the pane that lets you do magnification with the keyboard, and it has other accessibility options. I opened that, and I noticed that zoom was turned off. So, oh, that must be the problem. So I turned it on, and I clicked that special mouse button, and the toggle turned back to off on zoom. So I clicked it again, and zoom turned on, and I clicked again, and zoom turned off. Well, that was exciting, but nothing was actually zooming. So still in the OS X preference pane, I found a max zoom slider. There's a max and a min, and the maximum was set to 1 out of 20. So I figured, oh, well, it's trying to zoom, but it's just not going anywhere because it's set to 1 to 1. So I slid that little sucker up to 20, and no, it still doesn't do anything. So Susan or anyone else out there who has messed around with this Give me a hand, will you? I'm kind of confused how this thing works. I'm sure it's something embarrassingly obvious that I will never admit on the air. Well, speaking of mice, this week I was talking to my friend Fred, and he was telling me about how his girlfriend has a Mac, and he was complaining about how lame the single-button Apple mice are, and questioning why on earth Apple doesn't fix this horrible problem. I sweetly told him that no self-respecting Mac person actually uses those mice. We all just dump them in a little drawer that we keep around for emergencies, and then we go buy a real mouse, like one from Microsoft, for example. He was simply floored by this news. He exclaimed. He was wowed. He said he'd be a hero when he brings one home to his girlfriend. And then he said the best possible thing. He said, let me guess, if I'd listened to a certain podcast, I'd have known that by now, wouldn't I? I had to crack up because, of course, I had covered this very topic just a couple of weeks ago on the podcast. I couldn't have enjoyed it more. Well, I started messing around with RSS aggregators these last couple of weeks. Those are the readers that you can hook up to look at a website or a blog and get the weekly written text, or daily, or whenever it's written, I should say. So I've been trying to understand how they interact with my blog entries. I had heard that WordPress can automatically does create your RSS feed, but I couldn't figure out where to find it and how to make sure that just the headlines, like the snippet at the beginning, would display instead of the whole darn blog. You know, I write an awful lot of show notes, so I just want that first piece where I tell you what's in this latest episode. I create my RSS normally using Feeder, as you all know, so it does just have that snippet at the in the feed. But I wanted to see the one that WordPress creates. So I'm making one in Feeder and I'm putting it up on my website, but WordPress is also creating one. So I thought, well, I want to see how that works. So I didn't know what I was doing, so I put a plea out to the Tech Podcast Network. And thanks to Adrian Bacon of Microsoft Newslog Podcast, available at microsoft.quicksurf.com, I now know how to make this work. Turns out in WordPress, there's a sneaky little field called excerpt. I mean, excerpt, come on, I didn't know that was it. So I've been ignoring that little field. And it turns out if I put the snippet right in there, it comes into the automatically generated RSS feed. So now if you point an RSS newsreader at my blog, you'll get just the first few lines that tell what's in the show notes first, and then you'll be able to see the rest if you choose. Adrian actually showed me where the URL is for the WordPress-created RSS feed, and it turns out it's kind of a standard naming convention. It's at podfeed.com/?feed=RSS2. So whatever somebody's website is, .com/?feed=RSS2. I'm not sure you're as fascinated with all this as I am, but I thought it was really cool. Plus, I figured out a while ago that having everything I think is interesting in my show notes makes it easy for me to find stuff later that I can't remember. I just go over to my website and use the search. Works great. In my quest for this capability, I also tried out a couple of interesting RSS readers. I found a really cute little cross-platform, open-source, Java-based RSS reader. By cross-platform in this case, I mean Windows, Linux, and OS X. The RSS reader is called ThinFeeder from thinfeeder.sourceforge.net. The download choices included a binary file with the word all OSs in it. So I said, well, that's got to be the good one. I don't want to pick a specific one if I can have all the OSs. So I picked that one. The README file gave me some obscure geek speak instructions about command line launching and putting things in my paths. I don't know, but my eyes always glaze over when people talk about putting stuff in a path. I still cannot get what that means. So I just hunted around in the directory it created upon installation, and I found a file called thinfeeder.jar. So being a Mac user, I just double-clicked on it to see what would happen. And it just opened up, worked just fine. Now here's where it gets really cool. I switched over to Windows under Parallels, and from there I navigated over to the OS X Applications folder, found the same thinfeeder.jar file, and I double-clicked it, and it launched perfectly in Windows 2. The crazy thing was that when I thought about it, I realized I was running the exact same binary file in two operating systems at the same time. That's good programming. That's cool right there. I don't care who you are. That's good stuff. If you don't believe it, you can take a look at the screen snapshot I put in the show notes. Both applications are running the same exact version, just set up exactly the same. It's crazy. ThinFeeder is only 1.2 megabytes for the download, and that's for the all OS version, so that's sweet too. Let me give you a little more info on ThinFeeder from the developers that might get you excited about it. ThinFeeder is a software that aims to provide a cross-platform, powerful, and tiny RSS/Atom aggregator for desktop using the Java development language. It has a few goals that wants to make the reading news experience the most pleasant possible. Anti-aliasing support on any operating system, skin support, multi-language support. Within the languages, it's got Catalan, Dutch, English, Esperanto, French, German, Portuguese, Spanish, and Swedish. So that seems like a pretty good little tool there. By the way, I noticed one thing. While the standard for OS X has always been Command-V to paste, and it's been Control-V in Windows, if you use ThinFeeder on the Mac, you have to use Control-V, just like you do on Windows. I've gotten to where I'm kind of jumping back and forth between these two operating systems so much that I forget what I'm doing, so I stumbled across the way to paste accidentally. Anyway, check out ThinFeeder. It's a pretty cool little application. The next RSS aggregator I tried is an open source extension for Firefox called Sage from sage.mozdev.org. That's mozdev.org. Again, all of the links are always in the show notes. And, of course, Sage is cross-platform between OS X and Windows as well. I'm not sure about Linux right now because I'm in the process of blowing out my CentOS installation on Parallels because I loaded it wrong. I think I can make the experience a little bit better on the Linux side, so I want to start it over again. Hopefully, I'll get that running soon and be able to test things in all three OSs in the future. So anyway, back to Sage. If you've ever installed an extension in Firefox, if you've never installed an extension in Firefox, you're in for a treat. This is such an easy thing to do and lots of fun. Open Firefox, pull down on the Tools menu, and go to Extensions. A new little window will come up that in your case will be empty, but at the bottom it says Get More Extensions. Click on that link and it'll take you to addons.mozilla.org/extensions. You can browse around there to find what interests you, and when you download it, it automatically adds it to Firefox, and then all you have to do is restart Firefox, and your new extension will be there under the Tools menu. Quite a while ago, several months ago, I talked about an extension that helps me a lot that I use in Firefox, and it's one that allows you to spoof that you're actually running IE on a PC, and of course I'm doing that on the Mac side, and it helps me to be able to use Firefox for sites that think you have to use Windows, but they're wrong. Anyway, Sage 1.3.6 installed easily, as do all Firefox extensions, and it now gives me a side panel that stays open unless I choose to close it. When you hit a site that has an RSS feed, you simply click the magnifying glass and it searches for available feeds. I went to my personal favorite podcast, the MacCast at maccast.com, searched for feeds, selected it, and said close. Now in the side panel, I have the MacCast and I'm able to click on it and a beautifully formatted array of recent blog entries in my Firefox main window comes up. The formatting is actually what really makes this such a pleasing tool. It's organized into blocks for each entry with kind of a pale green greenish bar at the top of each entry with the titles to separate them. I put the screenshot in the show notes so you can see how nicely done this is. Really, really looks nice. Makes it a pleasing experience. There's something about the UI that I really, really like. By the way, Safari does RSS reading built into the browser, which is awesome. But I did want to find cross-platform solutions so everyone can play. If you have a favorite RSS reader that's cross-platform, let me know so I can share it with everyone. By now, you've probably heard that Google has come out with a spreadsheet program that works online. I heard a review of it on Buzz Out Loud, the CNET podcast of indeterminate length, and Molly Wood asked the reviewer, is this cool because it's cool, or is it cool because Google's doing it? And the guy she was interviewing said, totally, because Google is doing it, because it's not really that good. I thought that was an insightful question and a great answer. However, the main point is, it is cool. So anyway, you can check it out for yourself at spreadsheets.google.com if you have a Gmail account. One of the things I do pride myself on, by the way, is the ability to break beta software. So I figured I had to go out and test this stuff for them, because it is in beta at this point. The very first thing I did was accidentally find a flaw in the software. And I don't mean a little inconvenience flaw, but where the math was actually wrong. So the first thing I did was put a 3 in cell A3 and a 4 in cell A4 and do a sum down below. So, you know, 3 plus 4 is 7, right? I'm really not that good at arithmetic, but I usually get 7. But for some reason, the first time I did the sum, instead of doing sum of A3 to A4, I did it down. So the equation was actually, or I'm sorry, I did it up instead of down. So I did sum is A4 to A3, and it came up with the wrong answer. It said 0. And so I tried it the other way around, and I said sum A3 to A4, and it came up with 7. So I thought, okay, maybe there's some invalid way of calculating. So I went over to Excel and did it, and of course it gets 7 either way you sum it. Well, now that I've proven I can break it, let's walk through a couple of the features. The first menu on the left is actually format, and that's where you can set the number format of the cells. Not only normal formats, but rounded, which gets rid of everything past the decimal. It has financial rounded, which is actually the same, except in parentheses, and negative, dollar and dollar and cents, percent rounded, plus various date and time options. They're not buried down inside a separate menu where you have to go and format, click on a tab. They're right there in front of you, so I like that. I tried out the sort function, which is actually on its own tab. I put 5 numbers in a column, starting about 4 rows down from the top. I selected just those 5 cells and hit sort from A to Z. And it did sort them, but it moved them all the way to the top, not still starting 4 cells down, which is clearly not what you really want. The real power of Google Spreadsheets is the ability to have several people collaborate on a spreadsheet at the same time. I haven't had time to fool around with this yet. Looks like it needs some cleaning up of the basic functionality first. But of course, I will keep playing with it. But from what we've seen at Google, I'm sure it's not going to take that long to come up with great improvements. Rose from Tanzania wrote in about, she was asking how to free up some disk space from her brand new installation of Tiger for the Macintosh. It turns out, Apple being an international business, they include every single language in the entire universe when they give you the installation. While many of you probably speak multiple languages fluently, unlike us ugly Americans who might speak maybe 2 on a good day, but anyway, you probably don't speak hundreds of languages and are unlikely to loan your computer to someone who speaks languages you don't. So during the OS X installation process, you can weed out other languages, but if only if you're alert and looking for the Customize button. I always miss it, so I end up installing everything in the universe. But there's an easier way. Monolingual from monolingual.sourceforge.net is an open source tool that'll allow you to get rid of unnecessary languages. I tested Monolingual on my installation, getting rid of every language except English, British English, and Spanish, and it saved me 854 megabytes, nearly a full gig. Looks like this is just what Rose needs. In addition to languages, Monolingual will remove unnecessary keyboard layouts. I'm figuring I don't need the Chinese keyboard, for instance, so I started running this capability too. I got rid of the ones I understood, like simplified Chinese, but left the ones I didn't understand, like SCIM keyboard layouts. Don't know what they do, maybe I need them. And I was able to save another 25 meg. Not as good as the language deletions, but room for a couple of podcasts anyway. The third thing Monolingual will do is move architectures. With no clue whatsoever what this means, I removed the architectures which were PowerPC G3, G4, and G5, leaving only Intel. Kind of made sense since I've got an Intel Mac. What do I need those other architectures? So nothing in this README told me what they are, and I was hoping they weren't important, so I just clicked the button. I'm watching this thing run, and you can see what it's erasing, and I chickened out when suddenly I saw real application files being deleted, like Atom and Firefox. And I got worried that maybe they were deleting the applications that run in Rosetta because they're made for the older processors. So I hit stop, and I went online and did some reading, and sure enough, this can delete your Rosetta functionality. I went back and ran both Firefox and Atom, and they were fine. Firefox is universal now, so that wasn't surprising. It still ran, but Atom does run under Rosetta. Personally, if I were you, I think I'd skip the architecture removal. Too scary unless you know what you're doing, or if you're some kind of mutant who actually reads the manual and could figure it out. Bottom line is that monolingual will definitely free up some hard disk space for you, so it's worth doing. Oh, by the way, remember when I said they have every language in the universe? I wasn't kidding. One of the languages you can remove is Klingon. Somebody had fun programming that in, I'm sure. My friend Diane sent me an interesting story about social engineering from a site called darkreading.com. Social engineering is a powerful concept. It's the basis for the social networking boom of things like MySpace and Facebook and Friendster, but it's also the basis for the success of phishing scams and other evil that takes advantage of human nature. You can have wireless encryption, virtual private networks, hard passwords, run software updates for security, and have your virus definitions up to date, but you can still just as easily be scammed by your natural human instincts. This was vividly illustrated by the author of the article over at Dark Reading. He took a bunch of USB thumb drives, put a self-launching Trojan horse on them, and simply left them lying on the ground of a parking lot outside of the front of a credit union. Just as he suspected, employees came in early, found them on the ground, took them into their offices with them, plugged them into their work machines just out of curiosity. The Trojan horse was set to collect passwords, logins, and machine-specific information from the user's computer, and then email the findings back to the author. Needless to say, their experiment worked flawlessly. 13 out of the 15 were picked up and plugged right in. I'm not really sure how to keep ourselves from doing stupid things like this. Our human nature is awfully hard to avoid. Oddly, the author never talks about what he did with the information he collected from the credit union. I'd like to think that he collected the credit union information, then called them and told them what he did, but he doesn't quite mention what he did with it. As I continue my journey using Parallels on the Mac, I find that I'm flipping back and forth between Windows and OS X with careless abandon. When I hit a spinning pizza wheel on one application, I switch to the other. Might be Windows or OS X, it doesn't matter to me. It's kind of liberating. I pretty much stopped worrying about it. However, it is highlighting a few things to me as I flip back and forth. One conclusion I've come to from my observation is that Windows is single-handedly responsible for carpal tunnel syndrome. I can't believe how many times I have to click yes or okay or don't ever show me the stupid menu again, which of course will show up the next time I pick something anyway. Some of this is because I'm an unsophisticated Windows user, but since 90% of the Windows users are probably at my same skill level, my conclusion stands. For example, every time I tell it to put something in the trash, it asks me if I'm sure. Why would I put it in the trash if I didn't want to throw it away? Okay, so maybe I accidentally dragged it there, but when I go to empty the trash, it asks me again if I want to throw it away. Come on, you can ask me before or after, not both. As I thought about my lack of skill, it did occur to me that there's probably preferences I could set to stop this, and of course, on the trash, I could get rid of the first, are you sure? In any case, I find that at least 20% more often in Windows than OS X, I'm asked to click OK or yes, or I really mean it. I really, really do. Really stands out to me. Now, another more subtle thing I noticed has to do with the fidelity of cursor picks. I noticed recently that I was using the arrow keys to move my cursor around in text. I didn't really think much of it. You know, my habits change from time to time. I just start doing things, figured it was just a phase I was going through. Then I was chatting with my friend Ryan, and he mentioned that you can't click as precisely in Windows. I hadn't even noticed which operating system I was doing it in, but there does appear to be a higher fidelity to the mouse click in OS X than Windows. Does this make any sense? Have any of you guys noticed that? I thought that was very odd. I'm finding that I open certain applications more naturally in Windows than in OS X, specifically Lotus Notes and Microsoft Office. They do run faster on Windows because they're written native to the Intel processor over there, so I think that's probably why I gravitate towards them. Another thing I really enjoy with having both operating systems is I can have Windows up, and I can just hit Command-H for hide, and Parallels hides in the dock instantly, and Windows is gone, and then I can just bring it back with a single click. It's really nice to just get all the apps out of the way and then just bring them right back. I am still bummed that I can't Command-Tab to swap Windows for other applications. The command key is kind of stuck inside Windows OS X, so OS X can't use it. I just figured out one way to do it, but it's a little more work. To get the control back to OS X, you can hit Control and Alt at the same time, and then you can hit Command Tab and the applications will switch. I hadn't thought to use Control Alt because its original use was way back in an early beta, You had to do that just to get the cursor out of Windows. But in more recent revisions, the cursor floats freely between Parallels and other applications. But now I've got a way to do it. It's still kind of hinky. I got to hit two keys and two more keys, but what the heck gets it done? Scott from one of the users groups of which I'm a member sent out a link to a really interesting open source application called Celestia from shatters.net/Celestia. That's spelled C-E-L-E-S-T-I-A. And of course, there's a link in the show notes. Here's his description. Google is to Earth as Celestia is to our universe. It is basically a map of our very own existence as we know it, or as Tom likes to put it, the good app. You can plot anything in our solar system from satellite orbits, asteroids, moons, other planets, or study our rotation in real time, or speed it up hundreds of times. You can also add more content or even other fictional solar systems, such as stars, things from Star Wars or Star Trek. It's really cool and something that's actually meaningful. Well, I started playing around with Celestia, and I have figured out how to go to planets using location, go to object. So I put in Jupiter, but I couldn't see anything. I figured out that scrolling up and down zooms in and out, and suddenly a faint outline of a planet came in view if I move very slowly. That's when I realized that the sunny side was actually away from me. Not sure why the default would be away from me, but it seems to have that in some sort of start position where all the sunny sides are towards you and some are away, so I guess it has to do with where they decided the sun was to start. So I hunted around and found that shift arrow keys would rotate the planet. Plain arrow keys actually move the planet, and the shift arrow keys actually rotate it. So I was able to rotate it and see the planet clearly. Next, I tried Neptune, and I couldn't find it. Well, that seemed kind of odd. I mean, I know Jupiter's cooler than Neptune because Neptune's so little, but I thought, you know, I would think it would still kind of have Neptune. So on a bet to myself, I quit Celestia and went back in, and that time it did find Neptune. Not sure why that would happen, but hey, it's open source. You get what you pay for, right? But when it did find Neptune, again, I couldn't see it when it said it was there. This time, it turns out I was inside Neptune, so I had to zoom out for where my search for Jupiter started me too far away, and I had to zoom in. As I zoomed out, again, the faint outline, and I had to turn it towards the sun. When I did get it to show, it was a beautiful color of blue and had the outline of a moon's trajectory around it. Pretty cool. The program did seem to automatically quit on me several times with no explainable provocation, which was kind of annoying, but it comes back up quickly, so it wasn't a huge impact. I tried to go to some non-planets, like the Horsehead Nebula, and it couldn't find it, even if I separated horse and head as two words or if I quit and went back in. My search for the Milky Way was also disappointing, just some blurry spots on the screen. I looked at the help menu, and it was just a long list of keystrokes you could use to get it to do stuff, some of which, when I pushed them, didn't seem to do anything. Like hitting the number pad was supposed to help you switch between planets, like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. That didn't do anything, though. There is a menu to display certain features, like the names of planets, moons, asteroids, comets, spacecraft, all kinds of cool stuff. Then there's a menu to display orbits of different things. Planets and moons' orbits are on by default, which explains why I could see Neptune's moon's orbit. I tried turning on the labels for spacecraft, and then turning on the orbits for spacecraft, but Celestia kind of fell down here, too. I went to Earth, and I could see the labels for Gemini, ISS, Friendship 7, and Hubble, but they weren't shown as orbiting. The labels were splattered on the surface of the Earth with no orbit showing if I zoomed in or out. Perhaps the orbits are too close to Earth for them to display easily. I hate to do this, but it looks like I'm going to have to download the manual. You know how I hate that. Luckily, I did find one on the website, and it looks pretty nice. So I look forward to planning my way through that until I get the hang of Celestia. Anyway, thanks for the interesting tip, Scott. This will provide me with hours of fun. So, I know you're tired of hearing me whine about heat from my MacBook Pro, but thanks to my friend Lloyd, you may not have to hear it anymore. Lloyd suggested I check out the iLap from raindesigninc.com. It's a very simple metal bracket thing with two padded areas, one for the front part that rests on your lap and one for the back. The laptop sits on the metal, so it naturally pulls a bit of heat away from the machine, but most importantly, it lifts the machine off of your lap so it stays cooler, and it kind of tilts it at an angle. Even if it does get hot, it's not going to bother you a bit. It's a little clumsy to carry around because it's kind of bulky, But it's very light and it's really, really comfortable. The price for how much it must cost to make is absurd at $50, but the price for the comfort it brings is not really too bad. I wish I'd taken Lloyd's advice a lot sooner. Well, it looks like that's going to wrap it up for this week's episode of the NoSillaCast. Please keep up all the great feedback. I really enjoy hearing from you. Remember, you can email me at allison@podfeet.com, and now you can leave me audio feedback at nosillacast@gmail.com. Thanks for listening, and stay subscribed.